Rest in peace, Mike Simonson. You will be missed. And we will pay tribute to Mike Simonson, our longtime reporter from Superior, coming up in our state capitol report. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I saw a car pulling a trailer with a very small house on it the other day. I wasn't sure if it was a fishing shanty or even an upscale outhouse. It was that tiny. When I posted the photo on Facebook, some people suspected that this person could be part of the tiny house movement. People who purposely downsize for sustainability and financial reasons, from a normal-sized home to a tiny house, one that could be 500 square feet or even less. Would you consider such a move? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest this hour can tell us about the benefits of living in a tiny house and the roadblocks that stand in the way of the tiny house movement. Let me welcome our guest, very happy to have with us, Greg Johnson, Director of Resources for Life, an outreach and public interest organization based in Iowa City. He is also president of the Small House Society. He has spent more than 8 years living in a home with less than 400 square feet, six of them in a mobile hermitage of 140 square feet. He also wrote a book about his tiny house living, Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you so much for being with us. My goodness, 140 square feet. That is tiny, isn't it?
Pretty small, yeah. And that's sort of a generous measurement. It was 10 feet by 7 feet. That's the actual footprint. But with a loft in the upstairs, that added the extra square footage.
So tell us of your experience of living in that tiny house. What was it like?
It was, I think a lot of people initially have a hard time relating to that. And then when I make this connection of, you know, imagine going camping. Well, a lot of people have gone camping or stayed at a cabin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like doing that, like being on vacation, but for 6 years. Yeah.
So why did you decide that this would be something you wanted to do?
Well, I was already kind of interested in the idea of living smaller. I'd been staying in some, you know, efficiency apartments and seeing how that could work, both using technology to downsize as well as just putting some things in storage that I didn't need on a day-to-day basis. And so when I first met Jay Schaefer and found out that he was actually, you know, living in one of these tiny houses on wheels, as far as I knew, he was the first person to do so, I thought, well, that's fascinating, you know, that you could actually not just rent an efficiency apartment, but you could own an efficiency apartment on wheels, and then it would be yours, and you wouldn't have any rent or mortgage payments.
Yeah, so was there anything that you didn't like about it?
Not really. I have to say I really enjoyed the entire experience. There wasn't anything that frustrated me about it.
Mm-hmm. Is it just you in the home?
Yeah, so for those 6 years, it was just me, and then I got married in 2009, and my wife and I lived at that time in 360 square feet for a couple of years.
And what about right now?
We're kind of in between homes. We're looking at buying some land, so we're living in an apartment right now. Yeah, we're still in the Iowa City area. And, you know, part of the challenge that the small houser people have is, if your mindset like mine, if your mindset is on sustainability and green living, the places where you can legally build these tiny houses are generally more rural, you know, because in the municipalities there are small size ordinances, so you can't have a home smaller than, you know, maybe 700 or 800 square feet. So if you're building a tiny house out in the rural area, and then having to then drive your car into the city to work, that sort of defeats the purpose of trying to have the smaller carbon footprint, you know? Whereas if you can live closer to town and take advantage of just riding a bicycle or using public transit, then there's a gain there. But it's very hard to find land in the city. And I found land for 6 years, but then after that was unable to find something close to work. So that's my predicament at present.
Yeah. So why is it that most urban areas, make it difficult for tiny houses?
Well, I don't think there'd ever been, that I know of, the kind of tiny homes that we see today where they're built with either, you know, residential-grade materials or industrial-grade materials designed to look attractive and be safe, and that just was not, you know, on the radar. So most people would have equated some home smaller than 700 square feet with some kind of poverty or squalor, or somebody's just going to prop up some, you know, tin and plywood to make a shelter with a tarp thrown over it. You know, that's people's envisioning of what a tiny house might be. Well, now we're seeing very, very nice, somewhat expensive, you know, tiny homes that I don't think anyone would complain about having that in the neighborhood. But, you know, there is that concern that if there are not some sort of size standards, that then the quality of housing might deteriorate.
Yeah. Now, do you see that changing at all in terms of, for instance, it's not exactly everyone downsizing to tiny homes in Madison, but there is a tiny home village, and this was done as, in part, an answer to homelessness.
Right. So there are a few different paths right now with small house living. You know, there's some folks who are doing it just out of really kind of desperation, that it's either going to be living on the street or living in some safe, warm shelter. And if that has to be a tiny house, then that's fine. But for that moment in time, you know, so, and then you have people who are, you know, very well off, who could live in a average home of 2,500 square feet, but they choose to downsize and become minimalist and live in these tiny homes. But there is certainly that component where there are people who are either traditional homeless kind of folks, or people maybe just in a difficult time, you know, financially, where they look at this as an option for them. And there's, so, you know, as that becomes popularized, then I think people will be concerned that this is some kind of temporary housing, or it's something for homeless people, and it becomes known for that.
We will talk more about the tiny house movement in just a moment, and we welcome your questions for our guest, Greg Johnson, who knows what it's like to live in a tiny house. He's the author of the book, Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And this topic certainly struck a chord with our Facebook friends. Lots of comments on Facebook. A lot of people apparently find this idea appealing, and we'll share some of those comments in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We will get back to our discussion on the tiny house life and the tiny house movement in just a moment. But first, Bill Martins joins me to encourage you to make a pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio during this, our fall pledge drive. You can make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And Bill, we have a great reason to make that pledge right now.
$3,100 worth of a good reason there. We have a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now from the WPRA and Elaine Carmichael and Lane Kendig from Sturgeon Bay. So that's up to $3,100. Essentially, what that means is that your gift of $50 turns into $100, $100 turns into $200, and so forth. So take advantage of this match right now and double your support for WPR programs by making that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And Joy, you've got another good reason to give as
well.
That's
right. Pledge any amount and you are automatically entered to win two tickets on a WPR trip. You could choose between a holiday tour of Europe along the Rhine River. Boy, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
You could go on a trip to France, which also sounds good. Or you can take an Alaskan adventure, which really sounds good to me because I'm going on that one. That's going to be a lot of fun. We are going to be cruising up to Alaska, do that Inside Passage, and we'll have an excursion on a railroad to go to see some other sites in Alaska. June of 2015, that's one of three trips that you can choose from if you are the lucky winner of this wonderful drawing. So you can double the impact of your pledge with this matching dollar-for-dollar grant that we have going on right now, and you will be entered into the drawing, too, by giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, we get such good guests on WPR because they know you'll ask great questions, and they won't be interrupted by commercials either. It's your support that makes all of this possible. You are the most reliable part of our budget. So give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, I need to mention that everyone who pledges during this drive is entered into that drawing for two tickets on that that trip that you choose, but you don't have to pledge to participate. You can send a postcard with your name, address, email, and telephone number to WPR Trip Drawing, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. So enter by sending a postcard, or better yet, make a pledge right now. You decide the amount, any amount, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Hi, I'm Mike Crane, Director of Wisconsin Public Radio. During this membership drive, we're offering something very special. It's your chance to win a trip and to choose your own adventure. The lucky winner will choose between a holiday cruise up the Rhine River in Europe, an Alaskan adventure, or a getaway to France. No matter which trip you pick, you'll enjoy great lodging, great food, spectacular sights, and the company of WPR staff and your fellow listeners. Your pledge of any amount gets you entered, but no contribution is necessary to win. Sustainers, you're automatically entered. Find the details and the fine print at WPR.org/drawing. Or enter with your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Good luck.
Yes, good luck indeed. Pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Joy Cardine with Bill Martins asking for your support of WPR during this fall membership drive. You decide how much to give. Perhaps your gift is $10 a month or $20 a month. Whatever you choose, that's the right amount.
And we have a dollar-for-dollar match in effect this hour. That's up to $3,100 from the WPRA and Elaine Carmichael and Lane Kendig from Sturgeon Bay. So your pledge this hour will essentially be doubled. So if you make a pledge of, say, $10 a month or $20 a month, that'll essentially be good for $20 or $40. So this is a great time to make that pledge if you haven't done so yet. And you can do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And I should also mention that we do have a goal of 30 pledges during this hour. We have 27 to go. So please do make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And remember, every pledge that is made during this hour is going to be entered into that drawing for that trip, and it will be doubled up to $3,100 thanks to this this generous match. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thanks, Bill. We'll talk to you a little bit. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the tiny house movement with Greg Johnson, who is Director of Resources for Life, an outreach and public interest organization based in Iowa City. He's also president of the Small House Society. And we are welcoming your questions about the tiny house movement. Could you ever live in a house that was 500 square feet? What about 140 square feet? Well, our guest did that for a number of years, and he is telling us what that was like and discussing the movement to live tiny for environmental sustainability and financial freedom. And we're welcoming your questions for him and whether or not you would do this or not and why or why not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Lots of comments on Facebook. Laura on Facebook says, I love the movement. A big house serves two purposes. It's there to be filled up with stuff, and or it's there to say, look at all the stuff, house included, that I have. I want better than that for my children and for my grandchildren. So, Greg, what's your response to that?
Yeah, I think that's a common response that's out there. People are realizing that the excess clutter and materialism of things that are just depreciating in value ends up consuming our financial resources and our time to kind of organize and maintain all of those things. So it's interesting, one of the other commenters on Facebook was saying there's really no practical advantage to having less space beyond economic limitations. So I think, though, that people have found there is indeed, a benefit to living smaller. Things are all within arm's reach, basically. There's, again, less time consumed with upkeep of a smaller home than a larger one. And indeed, we find in the real estate market, homes that are in, perhaps not tiny homes on wheels, but homes that are in that 800 to 1,200 square foot range are on the market for less time than homes of the average size or larger, the 2,500 square feet to 5,000 square feet. I know somebody who had their home on the market for 3 years trying to sell a home that's about 4,000 square feet. And the reason is people just don't want to be tied down to something that's that big and that much of a financial commitment.
John from La Crosse emails, it's nice to see how some tech things help live smaller. Flat panel TV versus the old big ones, laptops versus the big desktop unit with big monitors, small radio stereos versus the old college lease breaker systems, ebook readers versus tons of books on the shelves, MP3 players versus stacks of LPs. So has technology helped us live smaller?
Yeah, definitely. The choice to live smaller in the past meant giving up a lot of stuff. And, maybe you wouldn't be able to live in a 10-by-7 square foot house if you had a large CD collection and DVD collection and lots of books on bookshelves and magazines and things like that. Well, everything I've just described can fit in a pocket-sized smartphone or certainly a laptop computer. So, in fact, we can live smaller these days, and yet even more abundantly than before. We can have thousands of CDs and thousands of videos and access to just about anything we want from a laptop computer. So I think that's made it possible for a lot of people to consider this way of life, or just to even assess their things. They just look around and they realize, wow, I don't really have that much stuff. Maybe I can get by living in a smaller space. And that may be a smaller house or a smaller apartment or even something as small as a tiny house on wheels.
Marcus on Facebook says, when asked, would you like to live in a tiny house? Nope, I am not tiny and I have committed no crime. I need and enjoy a certain sense of spaciousness. So is there any claustrophobia in a tiny house, Greg?
Well, there are definitely people out there that believe this is for everybody, And there's some people, though, that it doesn't work for, And somebody commented on Facebook about having two big dogs, There's people that maybe their profession requires that they have a grand piano, So it's going to be fitting a certain niche at a certain time. But regarding the claustrophobia of it, typically in these homes, even though they're small, you end up with windows on every wall. So wherever you're looking outside, basically. That's not the case in many apartments and homes where, not every room can have four windows facing, north, south, east, west, because there are going to be room rooms on either side. So you're actually going to feel a little more claustrophobic in a traditional home or apartment for that reason. And so, you know, because you're not looking at four walls, you're looking at four perspectives of nature around you. That's actually less of an issue. And you can feel like you can just step outside any time. But certainly, depending on a person's needs, you know, the family of four, a family of five, or the people with lots of dogs, that's just not going to be an option for them.
Let me hold you there as we have news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up next. And then we'll continue talking about what it's like to live in a tiny house. And we'll talk more about the tiny house movement, people choosing to downsize for sustainability reasons. I'm Joy Kerdine. We are in our fall membership drive, and your support is critical. It is the foundation of our budget. It is what makes Wisconsin Public Radio your go-to place for great programs. We will get back to our conversation about the tiny house movement in just a moment. But first, I'm Joy Kerdine with Bill Martins, and we are encouraging you to go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552 right now and make your gift in support of the programs that you count on.
And there are a couple of great reasons to make the pledge this hour, and we're going to get into those in just a moment. First off, we've got a dollar-for-dollar match in effect right now from the WPRA and Elaine Carmichael and Lane Kendig from Sturgeon Bay. So your gift of $50 turns into $100, $100 becomes $200. Take advantage of this match and double your support for WPR programs when you give at WPR.org. or 888-202-2552. That grant is up to $3,100. We're about halfway there. So if you haven't made that pledge, there's still room for you to get in on that. Again, make that pledge right now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
I love sweepstakes or drawings for wonderful things and challenge grants, because we also have going on right now, if you pledge any amount, you are automatically entered into a drawing to win two tickets on a WPR trip. You can choose between a holiday tour of Europe along the Rhine River, an Alaskan adventure, or a trip to France. It's going to be a hard choice if you're the winner. So double the impact of your pledge and get your name entered into the drawing right now by giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm going to mention one other thing as well, Joy. For $5 a month, $120 a year, $60 a year, I'm sorry, can't do my math at 6:38 in the morning. Ask for the WPR logo secure ID tags. So you put one on your phone, one on your keys, and then if you ever lose those tags will help you get those things back. So protect your stuff and your public radio station by making that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. So you can get the ID tags, have your pledge doubled, and maybe even walk away with a trip at the end of the drive. So this is the hour to act.
This is lots of incentives to make that pledge right now. And of course, though, the most important reason to pledge is that because Wisconsin Public Radio is listener supported, and you are the most important part of Wisconsin Public Radio's budget. Do make your pledge of any amount. Maybe it is that $5 a month level. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You share every weekday morning with the Joy Kerdine Show. Maybe your alarm clock wakes you up to it, or you share your breakfast in the kitchen with us, or you drive to work with us, whatever. Your morning wouldn't be the same without this program and our guests. So pledge your support for these morning conversations at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, thanks to Nancy and Mark from Nina, who did pledge, and they say, we listen to WPR daily on our morning drive. Not having WPR as part of our morning routine would be as bad as having to give up our morning coffee.
That's serious.
You know what I did yesterday, Bill? I accidentally made decaf coffee in
the
morning.
Boy.
That was really a mistake. But anyway, Nancy and Mark, thank you so much for your pledge. I'm so happy that you listen along on your morning commute and that you care enough about Wisconsin Public Radio to make a contribution. That's what this is all about. Make your contribution. contribution now and have it doubled. We have this dollar for dollar match going on right now up to $3,100, and we still have half of that to go. So don't miss out on this opportunity. Make your pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
All rise. Department 1 of the Superior Court is now back in session. Honorable Judge Wilson presiding.
Please be seated. Attorney Mailer. Return to cross-examine the expert witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Now, sir, remind us, you're a soil scientist?
That's right.
And you said the soil in the victim's garden matched the soil on my client's shoes?
Yes, they were both silty with an unusual amount of copper.
Would you say that soil is ideally suited to growing cucumbers?
What I'm sure of is the soil in the victim's garden is the very same soil in the shoes of the accused.
There have been many coyote sightings in the neighborhood recently. Is it possible that coyote droppings are enriching the soil for better resistance to tomato blight?
Your Honor, cucumbers, coyote droppings, tomato blight?
Attorney Mueller, I have to request that you stick with the issue at hand, and that's defending your client from some very serious charges.
Certainly, but can't we just ask about common garden insects before moving on?
Yes, Larry Mueller could be a defense attorney, but isn't it better that he's hosting the Larry Mueller Show on WPR? Your support makes WPR programs possible and gets to the bottom of that tomato blight problem. Give now. Here's someone to tell you how.
Larry, could you see Larry as an attorney? Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and make your pledge during this fall membership drive. Make that pledge because you value all of the information that you receive on Wisconsin Public Radio, from gardening advice on Larry Mueller's show, to talk about politics on this show, to talk about the tiny house movement, which is what we're talking about this hour. Make a pledge to support all of what you value on Wisconsin Public Radio, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Nathan from Madison says he pledged for the dollar for dollar match that we've got going on this hour, up to $3,100. So if you make a pledge of $50, that'll be good for $100. And we're a little more than halfway to that goal right now. So go ahead and make that pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you very much, Bill. We will talk to you at the end of the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about the tiny house movement and the tiny house life with our guest, Greg Johnson, who is Director of Resources for Life and president of the Small House Society. He also wrote a book about his experiences living more than 8 years in a home with less than 400 square feet, and six of them in a mobile hermitage of 140 square feet. He is the author of the book Put Your Life on a Diet: Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. We welcome your questions and any experiences you might have in tiny house living. And we also welcome any thoughts on this movement. Would you consider moving to a tiny house? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Now we have some callers who have been waiting through news. Barbara in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Barbara.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I used to live in a tiny house that I built for myself in the woods in northern Minnesota. And I lived there for a year and a half, and it was the happiest year of my life. It was about, 10 by 14 feet. And I had everything that I needed. And now I'm living in Milwaukee. And, you know, overlooking Lake Michigan, my lifestyle is quite different, but I was happy there.
What made it so happy for you, Barbara?
I didn't have electricity. That was one thing. And then I was like, I could go outdoors and I could do everything that I needed to do by myself. I was self-sufficient. And here, you feel helpless a lot of times and dependent on society when you can't do things for yourself. And having my own small place on my own small piece of land made me feel self-sufficient.
Yeah. And a reaction to that, Greg? Greg, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry about that. I had the mute on.
Oh, that's okay.
That's a really interesting point, that it's the opposite of what you might think when somebody doesn't have electricity or in my case, I also didn't have running water. I very much enjoyed that kind of back-to-the-earth feeling of carrying my water to my home. And I think a lot of people would comment that those luxuries that you think are adding something at some level are kind of making you feel dependent on a system that's outside of your control. I guess that's probably also the argument that the Amish make, that they want to have a sense of being in control of their day-to-day needs, whether it's water or other such things.
Yeah. So what is the... talk a little bit more, Greg, about... to certain people, this is appealing. Why is this good for society, for people to live in tinier homes and use fewer resources?
Well, I guess if you were to visualize, somebody driving around a semi-truck every day for their morning commute, that vehicle's much more than they really need to get to work. And for many people, we don't think about it. We just emotionally buy into the idea of, I want to be like everyone else, so I'm going to buy a 2,500-square-foot home. And it's like driving that semi-truck to work. For one person who, if they were to really think it through, maybe would realize they'd want their priorities put elsewhere. So in some regard, it's good at that personal level. There's certainly an environmental impact that living smaller can have. And that's good for society. But I think it also, for people who are going through this process of intentionally downsizing, it makes a person really think through their stuff and then think through how that relates to what means, what's meaningful to them, what matters in their life. And so they can start paring away what doesn't matter and focusing in on what does matter. Because often our material things are connected to our kind of emotional and purposeful life.
Thank you very much, Barbara, for letting us know. John in Muscadet is with us now. Hello, John.
Well, hello. Thank you for taking my call. There's an entire demographic of people who've been living in tiny houses for years. We're called full-time RVers. And we live in our trailers or motorhomes or something like that, and we're entirely self-contained, and we travel all over the place. Or we can just stay in one place, like I've been doing for the past year.
I'm sorry. Tell us more about what it's like where you're living.
Well, I'm living in a motorhome, and right now it's actually parked in Muscadet behind the house that we used to own that is now for sale. So as soon as the only thing I'm dependent upon is the weather. Otherwise, I'm pretty well self-contained. So there's the advantage of having everything where I need it in 270 square feet, and the fact that I can move it if I wish to.
Mm-hmm. Is this like a mobile home that, Greg, a tiny house is like a mobile home?
Yeah, that phenomenon of people, whether it's just for the winter months going somewhere to live in an RV or year-round, that has been going on for a long time. So people have, again, pursued this as kind of a vacation or retirement lifestyle, and now we're seeing it moving more into kind of mainstream day-to-day living. The slight difference that you might see between an RV that might be designed for occasional seasonal vacation use and a tiny house that might be more ruggedized for year-round living is that possibly some of the appliances and surface materials used and the exteriors may be a little bit sturdier, although that really depends on the quality of the camper that you have. And there's another component, I think, of the tiny house movement. For the people like Barbara who, built the home for herself, there's a sense of real self-sufficiency and, the fact that you're engaging your own creativity to make something with your own hands, which is different than just buying something that's pre-made. So I think that, takes into effect. And certainly the people that are living full-time in RVs, if it's retired folks or people that are, just graduated from college and don't have commitments yet, there is that at either end of the spectrum. You can imagine you know, younger people who, again, maybe don't have a family, don't have a lot of material clutter built up, they have a lot more freedom to live small and to travel. And equally is the case with people who are retired often. You know, the kids have moved out, the parents have moved out, and so they can get up and travel or live smaller. And there are people in those middle years, though, that just don't have that possibility if you have a big family and career commitments. So I see that the small house living is really an option for those who are in the right point in life where it works for them.
So once you make this decision that you want to live in a tiny house, how do you get one? How do you find a place to park it? How do you find the land to build one in the first place?
Well, each area is different. You know, there's some cities like Portland, for example, where they have municipal codes that accommodate what they call accessory dwelling units. And so finding land is just as easy as either buying land and renting out a house, which is what, you know, John was saying. You know, there are many people that they'll buy a traditional home, they'll put a tiny house in the backyard, and then they'll rent out the larger traditional home. That pays their mortgage and then some. Mm. So essentially they get a place to live for free and they get a mortgage paid off. So there's, you know, that option. But as far as finding people to build, we have the smallhousesociety.net, and that works also as .org, website where people can go and get connected with local builders, or if you want to find somebody who's a small house designer and purchase the plans and have somebody locally build it for you, there are many options for that.
Dave on Facebook says, builders in Oneida County have wanted to get into this growing architectural movement, but county zoning does not permit tiny homes as permanent housing. Perhaps, he says, we should call them deer hunting shacks. I mean, there still are, though, some zoning issues in certain areas.
Well, and that's what has really pushed this movement toward having tiny houses on wheels. I don't think everybody who has a tiny house on wheels necessarily woke up one day and said, oh, I'd like to build a tiny house on wheels. What they probably wanted was a little cabin or a little cottage or something that's slightly smaller than the legally required 700 square feet. But if you were to put a house on a foundation that's smaller than that, it's illegal and it'll get shut down. So if you put a house on wheels of the same size that's illegal on a foundation, but you put it on wheels, then it's suddenly legal because it falls under a totally separate, legal code, which has to do with accessory dwelling units or temporary housing and what John was mentioning, you know, RVs. Once it's an RV, everybody says, oh, it's fine. If John was to take his RV that he's been, you know, living in for a long time and he sets that on a foundation, it'll get condemned as being non-habitable. As soon as he lifts it up and he puts it on wheels, well, then it's perfectly acceptable. So that's kind of an oddity in the law right now.
So what do you think is the future of the tiny house movement?
Well, I think it's probably going to shake out in the sense that we're always going to have people who are sort of experimental like myself and others who are, you know, living in these tiny houses on wheels. I don't imagine that's going to work for everybody's lifestyle. There is something, though, called pocket neighborhoods. Ross Chapin is an architect who's been kind of spearheading this, but the website that folks can go to is pocket-neighborhoods.net. And the idea is to have maybe not 140 square feet, but homes of 400, 500 square feet, possibly 700, in little neighborhood clusters in urban infill. So this isn't off in a rural area somewhere. This would be right in a typical neighborhood, where there are these intentional communities, and again, because technology has allowed us to live smaller and people are just choosing to live simpler lives, you can have maybe 10 different families and individuals living and sharing a common, you know, central building for events, community events, and that type of thing, sharing the lawnmower, sharing a park area, and these pocket neighborhoods. Then I think that's really the future of tiny house living, because, you know, when you combine your resources with someone else's and you start sharing, then you need less stuff, and it's more economically beneficial.
Well, I want to thank you, Greg Johnson, for being with us. This has been really fascinating.
Thanks, Chuck.
Greg Johnson is the author of Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned from Living in 140 Square Feet. He is also the president of the Small House Society. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.